Hello, world. Welcome to Sudden Movements, episode 4. Let's get into it. I just am going to catch up real quick from the year ago podcast that I did last. It's been 3 years since I started this podcast, and we're on episode 4. It's going well. I moved from Tennessee to North Carolina. That is awesome. I'm closer to my daughter, closer to Jess's family. It has many reasons that this is a better move for my life. Moving from Tennessee, that house that I had was so difficult for me. I consider myself an animist, as somebody who sees life in everything, even inanimate objects. Like, ever since I was a kid, I had it. You know, when we're all kids, we attach to our stuffed animals. We think they're real. We talk to them. We relate to them. We miss them when they break or get lost. It's a real emotional roller coaster with something that, for most people, seems to be devoid of life. A second memory I had when I was a kid was when we got rid of our first car. We had an old Woody Caravan that we did a couple vacations in, and I just had a lot of memories in that car. And when it came time to sell it, I remember just for a week or so being so distraught. I cried when we had to say our last goodbyes to it and went off to a junkyard. It wasn't really sellable, so I knew it was not going to have another owner. And this just destroyed me as a kid. I couldn't handle the fact that that car was going to be sitting in a junkyard for the rest of its time on earth, or it was going to be ripped to pieces and used for parts. And I remember it feeling so real that it was like it was dying, you know? And as I've matured through life, I still find it's something that I maybe for the early part of my adulthood, I didn't voice, and I turned off a little bit. I tried to suppress because it felt like I was crazy emoting in that way. But now, where I'm at now in my understanding of life and consciousness and myself, I think it's fucking real. And I love it. I love living like that. There's a whole nother dimension of reality, I feel like, that I can tune into. And sometimes it's tough because when I have to get rid of a mundane object that doesn't work anymore and I have to go throw it in the trash can, it does feel like I'm killing something. But I like that I can have the intention and awareness to let it go and see it as somebody else that might not be seeing it for what it is. So I really value that part of myself. However, leaving my Tennessee house was one of the toughest things I've ever had to do, because this house was like a dream home. It was a big property. It had so much, so many places in the entire house and property that I thought were so magical. And I didn't realize how much I had connected to it until I had to leave it. And I spent a couple weeks before we left just grieving the entire place, standing in a room for an hour and just soaking up all the memories I had. And it was tough. But anyways, I'm in North Carolina now, and it's fucking awesome. I'm close to my daughter. I found a really cool old house that has got super vibes in it. And we're in a neighborhood that's closer, or it's better for the kids that we have here. Having neighbors, being able to trick-or-treat, kids in the neighborhood, stuff like that. In Tennessee, we're pretty much out in the woods. So, next, what else? What else has been going on? I've learned that I'm a people pleaser. It fucking sucks, too. I've been a people pleaser my whole life, I think. Or maybe at some point I wasn't when I was a kid, but I think I used to think that doing things for others when I didn't want to, or just doing it to present as somebody that's philanthropic and cares about other people, I always thought was a good service. That it meant that I was a genuine, sweet person who cares about other people. But I did it to the extent that was, now I see, very unhealthy, because I was sacrificing my own being, my own uniqueness in a lot of scenarios. And so I did it for a long time that I think got me into a place where I literally didn't know who I was anymore because I was mostly performing for others. And this was a really hard revelation. It had gotten me to a point where I didn't have a lot of happiness in my life. The people that I had surrounded myself with, the job that I had, the responsibility to others that I was taking on, just left no time for my own self-exploration and happiness and finding happiness in who you are and what you're doing. And I didn't, you know that this is what it was in that time. But I can see now in retrospect, it's what led me to seek for understanding in myself and why I wasn't happy and what was causing that. And eventually that leads into a lot of spiritual concepts, consciousness, and things that, you know, were so life-giving to me. But it was a habit, this people-pleasing, that it was so hard to switch off and change. And I'm still working through a lot of the habits that come up when I'm just out in public grocery shopping and tend to want to involve myself in somebody else's problem or change their perception of me. And it's interesting because when you look online, I was just looking at this a minute ago, and it's funny because Google's never, you know, it's hard to find valid information on here anymore. You have to take it with a bit of discernment, but you type in people-pleasing on Google, and of course, the first thing that pops up is WebMD. Listen to this description. It doesn't help at all. A people-pleaser is typically someone everyone considers helpful and kind. When you need help with a project or someone to help you study for an exam, they're more than willing to step up. If you recognize yourself in the above description, you may be a people-pleaser. Great. It doesn't really give me anything about some of the bad parts of it or maybe why. It's just kind of presenting it as like a good aspect or it's like saying that's a good person. But then you go down a little bit more and there's some other deeper descriptions of it. People pleasing is a common behavior that can stem from a variety of underlying causes, such as low self-esteem, a fear of rejection, or a desire for validation. When you are eager to please others, it's key to explore the root cause in more depth. Thank you. That's a little bit better. And I think that's what caused, I started to look at why maybe I was people pleasing. And a lot of things online say it comes from a childhood trauma or being abused by parents or guardians or an intimate partner, perhaps. I didn't have an abusive childhood. I had a great childhood. However, when I look back, I mean, I made great of it. But I did have some issues with my father, who was sick the whole time, ever since I can remember. And he was a bit of a narcissist in some ways. But I think that that's some of where I got it from. And then being successful in my career put me on a platform where I was seen by a lot of people. And I think there was a bit of fear of being misunderstood or not seen for who I was, which is a paradox because when you people please, you damn well aren't going to be seen for who you are. I didn't understand it that way. I thought I was doing the right thing. But this has been something that I've gone through a lot over the last, I'd say, year or two, trying to uncover what exactly was motivating me to do that. And it's a bit embarrassing to even to accept in myself because on one side, I do hold myself to be very authentic and be very real. But I'm only that way with people that I really trust and love and people that I know see me deeply. Everybody else on the external, I tend to bend towards and sacrifice a bit of my authenticity, which is brutal on my own inner self. You know, it's abandoning that part of me. And it's hard sometimes because I think there are many moments where I would, if I was going to be authentic in the moment, it might have involved a hard no or a boundary setting that is can feel like it's rude or negative towards someone else. And I always wanted to avoid hurting other people. I definitely had some trauma in my middle school experience that comes from the fear of hurting others when I'm not aware. I was a popular kid in middle school. I think I've told this story before, but I was a popular kid in middle school, and for reasons I don't know why, I just in middle school, sometimes that's what happens. It wasn't like I was trying to be that, but I got in a situation once where it was like a friend on the outside of my group that would hang out all the time after school. She decided one day that she just needed to tell me what she was feeling, and she expressed to me so much hurt that I was causing to her by being this popular person. And it really was, I think she just felt slighted and not involved by me in the circle that we had. And so she threw that on to me, when it really wasn't my fault, but I was just mortified that I was causing pain like that to somebody by being in this elevated position of being popular, you know? And I think that really fucked me up for a while. I didn't know how to not make that happen again. And I wasn't aware really this was this other person's issue. But I think that did generate a lot of this urge to people please and make sure that I was never hurting someone. I always wanted to say the right thing. And I think I was just more focused on trying to perform as the right person instead of just being me, which is the right person. It's the correct thing to do, even if it's a hard situation where you want to say no, and that's going to kind of disappoint someone else. So there's so in depth to me this idea of people pleasing, and how I think a certain aspect of our culture looks at it as a positive personality trait, but it gets you in a mess of trouble when you sacrifice your own authenticity to please other people. It's a really cowardly thing to do, to be honest. understandable if it's coming from trauma or something like I'm describing, you know, so that it's kind of a subconscious thing, but that's a wild revelation I have had in the last couple of years. It's quite a rant. But anyways, the next thing I have listed as ketchup, not the condiment, but as a ketchup from the last year, Hashimoto's. I got diagnosed with Hashimoto's, which might have something to do with people pleasing, to be honest. Hashimoto's is like a thyroid disease. It's an autoimmune disease. It's an in-depth dive if you really care about it, but it's nothing life-threatening. It's a very mild case of it. And there's a lot of things that I think that's come from. It's also a physical thing. I haven't had enough B vitamins and all this, you know, medical stuff, but I've never taken medications or anything because it's not that serious. And I'm not really about taking medications, to be honest. But I have been taking supplements, vitamins, and changing my diet to help that. But the interesting aspect is that I now look at life with any kind of ailments that come up. I think there's a physical part of it, and then there's a spiritual part of it. And the spiritual part of it to me has been, because the thyroid is in your throat, and it seems to be tied to like the throat chakra and speaking your truth. And if I spent many years not paying attention to that, not paying attention to speaking my truth in the moment and people pleasing and trying to perform for others, I am suppressing a certain aspect of myself that over time will make me sick spiritually and then physically. I think it goes in that order. You know, we are spiritual beings living a physical experience. And so everything kind of in this reality is first stirred up in the spirit realm. And that's what I think was really had finally manifested in the physical realm as what they call Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid malfunction. So that was a pretty interesting revelation as well, that I thought more than anything it was a synchronicity for me to really understand the spiritual aspect of it. And so these two things tie together. People pleasing and Hashimoto's, I think they are one and the same. So if you're people pleasing out there, fucking stop. Try to understand where you're coming from when the desire to do that is, or you'll get Hashimoto's, and you don't want that. Next is my dog died. It's a real happy statement. Both the dogs I had that I had in Nashville are now gone. They're now in the ether, in the spirit place. But I just mentioned this because it's fascinating to, I don't know if you've, I'm sure many people have lost pets or lost loved ones. And it was really, really tough. He got diagnosed with a brain tumor, and he was slowly declining. We were doing everything we could to kind of use natural medicines to stop it or take off some of the pain, mitigate some of these things. And when you get a brain tumor like that, it's not much you can do. It's just about timing. He starts to fade away. And so we finally got to a point where it felt like it was time to let him go. And just like my other dog, Meka, that had died, we brought someone here to send him off, to euthanize him, which was the best way to go if you're ever going to do it, because you can kind of be prepped. You can have a lot of intention and keep them in their comfort place, and they don't even know what's happening, really. So it was a real beautiful experience. It's one of the toughest things, saying goodbye to a loved one. It's beautiful in the same sense, I find it, oddly, because you're able to just purely absorb all the memories and the special qualities that the other being has, you know, in the days leading up and then even in the moments just before. It's really tough, but it's such a beautiful experience to help guide them through that that experience. And funny thing is, animals, I think, go really easily through it. It's more about my trauma that I'm or my pain that I'm feeling than anything. But it was a good experience. I don't know why I fucking told you my dog died. I guess I wanted to sound smart about death, but in light of that, we lost our dog and got 12 kittens. Not necessarily by choice, but we had gotten 2 cats a couple years ago that we decided not to fix, which was maybe a mistake. And I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of judgment on not fixing cats because they are a bit of an issue, and people have issues with cats not being fixed. But we wanted to have that whole experience and let those kittens have the experience. So they decided to both get pregnant within weeks of each other and had 9 kittens. So we had 12 cats total because we have another cat as well. But man, that has been a roller coaster. We have a new house with a lot of cool carpet, and it's an old like 70s house that was pristinely taken care of. And we didn't have quite a good plan for that many cats at once. So we had to quarantine them in our probably the best room in the house, which is this like green room porch area that has so many windows, so much light, and we have all our plants in there. And that's kind of the only room that we can close off, and they can still get a lot of sunlight. So that porch has been a poop den and pee den for the last couple months, which is a bummer. But we're now down to 3 kittens because we got the rest of them good homes. And I think we might keep the next 3 kittens. Because cats are so fucking magical, man. They're really... I just love animals. And I think when I was younger, I kind of liked dogs more. But I had cats my whole life. But I've only fallen in with love with cats in the last like 6 years. Just because of their... just so much about them. Their autonomy. They don't really like rules. They got their own kind of thing. They can fend for themselves. They're pretty easy to take care of. And I recently learned that actually for people that are mystical leaning and spiritual leaning, the cat you know, the house cat, feline, is a mix, DNA-wise, it's a mix of a snake and a lion. Fuck, it blows your mind, right? Because there's a lot of symbolism in snakes and lions, if you know. And one of the signs of this is that their eyes, they have the diamond eyes, a straight line pupil, as opposed to cats or lions and all the other wild cats. They have the circle pupil, which is more like humans. So this is the only animal that is a mammal that has the straight line pupil, which is like a reptile, if you connected that. So all reptiles have that diamond eye. The cat, the house cat, is the only one that has the diamond eye. So genetically, they're a combination of those two, which is why I think they're also such apex predators. But it made me fall in love with them more. I think that's we got the moms fixed now, and so they no more kittens for us. But such a magical little animal to have around. Their purring too is like such a healing frequency, I've learned. There's a lot of really interesting things on the mystical spiritual realm to learn about cats. So I think that's all I have for the catch up. I'm going to do a bunch of questions because I thought it would be, I've never really done that. I know I've got a lot of like old band fans on my Instagram that have a lot of questions that will kind of fly through. And then there's some other people that listen to Jess's podcast and are more in this new kind of circle that I find myself in that is more conscious, spiritual kind of ideas. So there's a lot of really cool questions, but I figured it'd be a nice way to stir up some topics and discussion. Just as a caveat, I'm no authority on these answers. It's just my thoughts, my perspective. You can have your own perspective. If it doesn't resonate, then cool. I'm not the authority on it, so I know nothing. This is just my weird, wacky perspective. So I'm going to start with all the band questions, because if you are a fan of the band and don't care about all this woo-woo spiritual shit, then this can be the time that you get off once you get your questions answered. Some of the band ones, I'll do some of the music ones throughout, but some of the quick kind of surface level band ones. A lot of people are asking when is FTP going to release a new record. They haven't released anything for a while. Even when I was in it, it had been a year or two since we had released new music. There's a pandemic happening, obviously, and a lot of worldly stuff that I think didn't allow a lot of artists to create music in the same pace that they did before. So there was a bit of a pumping of the brakes on that in general. But I don't really know if they're going to release another record. I'm sure they are working on something. It just takes time to make good art. And so I don't talk to the guys on a regular basis, and I'm not updated on their current status of making music. So I do not have an answer for you. I know you want to hear an answer, but I'm sure they're working on something, and I'm excited to hear it when it comes. Another question was, what do I miss about being an FTP? I think the biggest thing that I miss was performing live with them. It was something that was just always so special and like untouched with any drama that we had as brothers and bandmates. It's hard being, you know, that close with somebody and traveling the world and growing together and having pressures and stuff. You get into little quarrels, as family members do. And whenever we had any of those problems, you know, when we get on stage, all of those things would go away. And I always held that very dear, that there was a place that we could all come together still and unite and make art and really purely express ourselves and put all those problems aside. And that always created this like magnificent, magical environment to play music. And I really felt like every time we got on stage, we transcended those problems and were able to really create a great atmosphere of music for people. And so I really cherish those moments. And I think it's hard to find that with people. And so that's the biggest thing I miss. And is the thing that made me, it was really hard to walk away from that because of that. And so it's something that I still do miss here and there. So yeah, that's that answer. What else was there? I'm trying to, there, I have like a lot of questions and I don't know exactly where all of those are, because there are a lot of good questions I wanted to talk about. There were some others like, do I talk to them anymore? We haven't talked in a while. I think we're all kind of doing our own things. Like I said, I wanted to check out of the public facing reality and tune into my family more and the things that really mattered to me. So that required kind of not checking into that aspect of reality. And I think the guys in the band were still excited to make new music, and we're in different paradigms right now. So I love them very much. And we have an open door policy where if it ever makes sense again, I'm sure we'll do music at some point together in the future. If it works out, if it feels right, if it's my truth, if it's their truth, then we'll do it. But I don't think anytime soon. I'm happy with my life that I'm living right now. And I hope that they are happy with what they're doing. Cool. Okay. I'm going to get into the questions. There are some more music questions here if people want to hang around that we're thinking of leaving. Okay. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to take another sip of my now cold matcha. First question. Does a podcast force you to seek out issues to talk about, or like pressure you to talk? Well, yes. That's why I asked for anybody's questions, because I didn't have a ton of ideas that I wanted to talk about. I mean, I've got ideas all the time. I am obsessed with seeking and learning things. And there are certain concepts that I'll come across that are activating for me to try to just unpack. And it's odd when you get on a mic or you start talking with someone else. It's an easier way to kind of probe the idea and pull out new perspectives of it. So I have that all the time, but I don't have like an ability to just get on a mic and quickly get comfortable and talk about those. So I usually just talk to Jessa about them or talk to somebody else about them and explore the thoughts that way. But I'm trying to get better at just being in the moment and unpacking, you know, some wild ideas about the universe and consciousness and beings and stuff. Yeah, I feel a pressure to talk a lot of times. And I think that goes back to this people-pleasing thing I was discussing earlier, is that from doing that for so long, not speaking my truth, it now feels like I want to practice it and in the moment and try to be more honest and speak my truth. So there is a little bit of a pressure that I'm putting on myself mostly to be public and speak and emote and all of that, all my weirdness. Next question is, do any spirits come to you for music? Other people come to me for music. There's a spirit portion of them, but no, I don't have, I've never had any legitimate spirit come to me for music. I think when you're in flow state, you're definitely conversing with another energy. And I find that to be a higher or broader aspect of myself, but it isn't like me. It's a big, big energy that I can relate to as myself in some form, but it's a very unique kind of feeling. And that's probably the closest that I come to from labeling anything else that's like a spirit, but it's not coming to me for music. I'm kind of going to it for music. And that's just like only accessible through a flow state, through really being pure about intention and being authentic when you're trying to create something. And there's many other ways to get into flow state, but it's not something you can just like turn it on and go in and say, I'm going to flow today and converse with the universe for creative ideas. But that's about as close as I would say that the spirits come to me for music. Favorite songs at this moment. I'm going to go to my Spotify really quick. There's a song that I've been listening to like on repeat this week. by the name is Empress Of, and the song is called Woman Is a Word. It's a really cool song. It's kind of poppy, but very, I don't know, something about it that's infectious. And then there's another song on here by a band called Weevil, W-E-V-A-L. And the title of the song is You Made It, Part 2. It's a banger. Is creating music and art a way for the universe to broadcast its ideas where we are the vessels? Yes, I believe so. It kind of pertains to what I was talking about earlier within the energy that is channeled. I believe it's an aspect of the universe, and it's an aspect of ourselves on a higher level, or broader level, I would like to say. Not necessarily higher as in better, but more knowledgeable, a wider view of the reality. And I think that's a part of the universe. And if you think about it, as a big part of the universe is not embodied in physical form. So this is spirits, ghosts, goblins, whatever you want to call it, the things that are not in physical form that you can't see. There's a lot of that out there, I believe. And those parts of the universe want to manifest into physical reality in some way, whether that being it's some kind of art form, whether that's a painting, whether that's music, film, sculpture, anything. And so it's trying to divinely inspire people that are in the physical realm to create something. But it does have to come with a co-creation. The physical being is a part of the process as well. So it's a co-creation, collaboration kind of. And I believe as you scale that up, it is the universe being artistic in its expression, just in a simple way. It's like really no moral to it. It's just wanting to create different things. So I believe we are all artists in our own ways, even if you're not someone that makes art, as you would name it, like a sculpture or music. The way you move through the world, the way you wash the dishes, do chores, do anything, can be from a creative, artistic space in the way you do it, the way you individually want to express that, I think is the point of life. And so having that like specific, unique aesthetic that each person has is a way to act out something of a higher realm of the universe trying to do something unique. So that's just the way I look at the world. And it is extremely valuable to me, because I don't find a lot of things super boring and mundane anymore when you look at it through that lens. Like washing the dishes is something that is, it's something that's like a chore, you know, and a lot of times I don't want to go do that. But if I'm in a balanced place and don't really have any pressure to do anything else, you can tune into washing the dishes in a certain way where it's like a dance. It's like it's a really fun thing to express in, even that kind of mundane of a thing. So from that perspective, it's like everything can be fun. Everything can be your own unique expression, if you will. Great question. Okay. Okay. This question's funny. It says, how many friends do you have? Funny you ask, because it is kind of a thing that I've, in the last 3 years, taken my own measurements on. Not because I really care, but it's been an interesting change in my life. I went from having what I would say now are a lot of acquaintances, but I would have called them friends then, in the wake of being successful in my career in the band. You know, it's easy to have a lot of acquaintances and a lot of friends. One, you have people that want something from you or want to be associated with you. And then you have a ability to meet a lot of different people. I'm traveling the world. I'm in a lot of situations that are unique, parties, awards, and things like this that like give you the opportunity to meet a lot of people. And so I think in like about 2019, I had a lot of acquaintances. I would say somebody that I had a lot of friends. However, I didn't have a lot of people that were close to me that I trusted, that I knew saw me for who I was. So the short answer is now, no, I don't have very many friends. And I'm cool with that because I actually, so like in the last 2 years, I annihilated my reality, I'd say, and left the circles of people that I was around for decisions that were true to me. And if you understand anything about human design, if you don't, this is going to not make any sense, but I'm a projector, a 4-6 projector, which one of the most important things about being a projector is that you be very intentional and cautious with the people that you surround yourself with. Because if you have the wrong people around you, you will find no satisfaction. You will find no happiness. Because my energy, the way it works, and my ability to be happy involves relating to somebody else in a certain way. And if it's the wrong person, I will never be seen and I will never be fulfilled in how I can relate to the other person. So turns out I had a lot of the wrong people around me. And that's not to state that these people were bad or wrong. They just weren't right for me and who I was becoming. I was doing a lot of self-seeking and a lot of deprogramming from parts of the reality and beliefs that I had that weren't meaningful to me anymore. And so I had to kind of exit stage left in whatever way I could. And, to be honest, it wasn't that difficult. I got a divorce and made some decisions that a lot of other people weren't happy with, I'd say. And they made their own, assumptions and decided to, you know, not talk to me anymore. And so it was actually really helpful for me because I was able to kind of disappear and find out the things that really mattered to me. And I was able to see the people that stuck around, that they really saw me or cared about me and reached out and asked what was going on. And this was it allowed me to kind of really see who those true friends were. And there weren't very many of them, to be honest. And again, I'm okay with that because the ones that stuck around, they do mean something to me, and I feel seen, and I know how I can be with them, how I can help them, and how they can help me. And there's a real love exchange there. The other acquaintances I had, there was always a difficulty, and it was just really hard to be myself. So having less friends in my life has actually been extremely fruitful and helpful for my own understanding of myself and my own happiness. So I wouldn't put a number on it, but I don't have as many friends as you'd think being in a successful band for 10 years. Okay. So how do I make music like yours, but in my own way? Your sound selection is next level. Well, thank you for that comment. I don't know. So how do I make music like yours? Well, you shouldn't try to make music like mine because you shouldn't try to make music like anybody except for yourself. And I know that's kind of an annoying answer, but the thing that I've learned over time is the true value that you have as a creator, as an artist, is what you uniquely have to offer and what you uniquely hear or want to hear and want to express. And the best way to find something that actually like causes others to get excited about it or enjoy the music is to be so yourself and not like anything else. So putting some kind of filter on and not trying to be like any other artist. It's okay to be influenced by artists, obviously. Like I'm influenced by a lot of art, music that I listened to growing up, but I do everything I can to figure out what I am inspired by in those other artists and then embrace that in myself, if that makes sense. And I try to, if I do end up, you know, I wouldn't say I try to replicate other artists, but I try to embody what they're doing. I just try to add as much as myself into it as I can. And I, to be honest, when I'm creating or producing or finding sounds, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I genuinely mean that, is that I have like certain talents that I have crafted over time, drumming. And I would say over time I've crafted a taste in my ear that I know what I like and what I don't like when I'm exploring sounds or exploring song structure or just any kind of form of the, of audio. And I just run with that and I explore pretty blindly with not a lot of limits on that. And so I just start tooling around in here, until I hear something that excites me. And then I keep running with that and kind of follow it where it goes. So I think it's, I understand the desire, like the question of you wanting to make something that you enjoy and something that is successful and that other people like. But the only way to that is to try to be as authentic with yourself as possible and bring to light what you specifically, uniquely have the tools for, which is everything from your whole life experience, the emotions that you've had, the losses that you've had, and the way that you move through the world, the way that you listen to music, the things you hear. It crafts in you a unique individual that has something to offer to the others, to other people, that is nobody else can do. You know, so if you're trying to be too much of someone else, you're sacrificing what you uniquely have to offer. And so there's not a lot of like rules or like pointers of how to do that. You have to kind of figure it out yourself, but doing everything you can to just be truly yourself, no matter how weird and upside down it is. That's the way to actually making something that you'll love, that you would be surprised to hear, and that other people, the right people, will love it. You have keys to other people in your art. I believe that it doesn't mean you're going to be like some wild, successful Grammy winner, but winning a Grammy is fucking stupid anyways. You don't want to do that. I don't think it's not worth it, but you just want to make something that like certain people love. It could be one other person and that's, the job is done. Okay. Done for that rant. I could go forever. The sound selection, you saying mine is next level. I appreciate that. But I don't really know what I'm doing, to be honest. I think I approach everything with, I have some technical abilities and tricks of the trade that I've learned that you can learn online anywhere. And you can also just learn by trying things. So I mostly have gone through the lens of just trying things. I get a lot of gear and tools and things to play with. And then I just start playing with it until I get into like a flow state and I get inspired and just try to tweak stuff until it sounds cool to me. So I think another thing to have is to try to develop your own taste, what you want to hear, what you think sounds good and what you think doesn't sound good and that you don't want to hear. And by having that own, like your own ear and being able to refine that yourself, and you just keep working at it, you will find something eventually that you like. And that's pretty much what I do. I don't really have the same way I go about it each time. I just turn knobs and play things until it sounds cool. And I'm not really trained in music. I mean, I was a drummer. I you know, was trained in somewhat of rhythm stuff like in high school, and I took lessons and things. And then I learned a little bit of music theory in high school. But when I sit down at the piano, like I know certain chords and certain notes, but I don't approach it like I'm going to play this in the key of C, or this chord is in the key of C, so I need to play these other notes as well. I just kind of put my fingers on there and play a lot of sour notes first, and then start to go, oh, well, this sounds good together. Like, cool, I like that. okay, now where to go from there? And then I play another, a lot of other sour notes until something feels good. And okay, oh, that feels, that's, I like that. Okay, unless these two things go together. Okay, now just do that until I get a song or until I get some kind of vibe. And then I'm not a vocalist by any means, but I sometimes will have a song done and then I'm like, I have a melody idea in my head. And so I'll pull up the mic and just start making sounds. And I can't do it with people around a lot of times, vocals anyways, because I'm pretty insecure with it. And I don't have, I'm not super sonically, I'm not in tune a lot with my voice. But I can get to a place where I'm like, oh, this sounds good. And this is congruent with the key structure or whatever. It sounds fine. And then even if it's a little out of tone or out of tune here and there, but the heart is there and the expression is there, it doesn't really matter. If you listen to a lot of songs, like especially the Beatles, there's so much stuff that's out of tune, but the heart is there, the soul is there. And so it doesn't really matter. So the thing I love about art is there's no fucking rules, really. A lot of people like try to put rules on to what makes good art, but there are no rules. All the geniuses of art never were following rules. They were breaking the rules, and that's what they made good art with. So that's what I find to be so inspiring, and I think we should, as artists, veer away from anything that's boxing us in and try to break rules constantly. Try to express yourself as purely as you can without any restriction. What inspires or excites you? Right now, I mean, a lot of things inspire me. Music inspires the hell out of me. It's my go-to for, it's like my emotional dumpster. Music just allows me to work out my emotions, and it's very, very tied to the emotion of music. So if I'm feeling somber and sad and I put on sad music, I can amplify that sadness or whatever it is, and kind of, it helps me process it. On the flip side, if I'm wanting to feel more inspired or excited and I put on music that's congruent with that, it amplifies it and it allows me to kind of milk that emotion a bit more. So music is always something that excites me and can inspire me. I'm inspired by a lot of like family oriented things right now too, like just being with my kids and trying to be present with them, going on little adventures and tuning more into house things, doing DIY projects. I love vibing out spaces. And so, this new house that we're in has a lot of opportunity for fun projects like that to enhance the space. And I really enjoy doing that. I have to be activated on it. So I kind of flip flop between doing music right now and DIY projects and, playing with kids. So that's what excites me, I guess, right now. And then I'm always into esoteric seeking stuff. I'm doing that all the time as well. Read a lot of books, listen to podcasts and things like that. Next question. My 20s are hitting me hard. Any advice to get over them without losing my mind? That's a hard question. I'm not really sure. 20s, like, God, when I was in my 20s, I didn't know anything. And I think that's great. Here's one thing of Bashar. If you've heard of Bashar, he's awesome. There's this guy, Daryl Anka, that channels this entity called Bashar. Whether you believe in channeling or not, I don't really care. But if you just listen to Bashar, listen to the information, it's profound. And you can judge for yourself if it's real or not. But if you just listen to the information, it's fucking powerful. And you apply it, it's powerful. And one of his things is, in any given moment, if you follow your highest passion, so the thing that excites you the most in the moment, and this doesn't have to be some artistic thing or some profound thing that's going to make your life change. It's like starting really small. Let's say you wake up and you're bored. You have nothing to do all day. If you just take a moment and stop and say, what do I really want to do right now? What is so exciting to me that I would love to go do, and not put any limitations on it. So I really just want to go mow the lawn right now. Like it sounds fulfilling to me. So just go do that. And then don't have any expectation on the outcome that it's going to change your state or that it's going to fix your problems. Just go step by step and say, that's what's most exciting to me. I'm going to go do that. And then do that until it's not exciting anymore, and then stop, and then find the next thing that you're passionate about that excites you, and then go do that. And don't put any limit on like what the world tells you you should or shouldn't be doing. If your desire is to like make a lot of great songs, and you think you need to work really hard to do that, but in the moment your passionate desire is to go have a coffee with a friend or just sit and read a book, do the passionate thing and don't say that that's you're deviating from the real work of what needs to be done for you to be successful. It's to follow your heart of whatever excites you. And when you do this for a while, you will find yourself to start to be in some kind of flow with the world, and things will start magnetizing to you that you desire. Those bigger things will start to come to you because you start to get into a frequency of joy and happiness and empowerment because you are creating it. And then you start to act on that on a bigger level, and you start to really magnetize the things that you really want in life. The right people start showing up, the right opportunities start to show up out of nowhere, like you wouldn't believe. It's a really magical way of thinking. And so I think broadly that's a good advice to have. And when I was in my 20s, there were a lot of times where I felt lost and didn't know exactly what I wanted to do or who I wanted to be. And had I had that advice in such a simple way, it would have been very helpful. I think I did do that a bit when I was younger because I didn't have a lot of pressures. I didn't like following rules. I was pretty, I liked bucking against rules. And so I kind of would always just do what excited me in the moment. But really knowing the power of it now, and when I do it now, how quickly it puts me into a state of happiness and thankfulness. So I would say try that and check out Bashar because he's really awesome. As a projector, this is a human design question. If you don't know what human design is, just go look it up. There's different types of, everybody's got a certain type of energy, and this helps you refine. You type in your date of birth and all this. It's like astrology mixed with the I Ching and all kinds of other things, but it's but it helps you understand your own energy, how it works in the world, how you've been aligned to work, and then how other people work. That's a horrible description of it. As a projector, how do you shut up and let people find their way when you can see the answer to help? Yeah, that's a hard one. If you can find some duct tape and cut a little piece off about the size of your mouth and just put that over your mouth, that's probably the best advice I could give you is to just shut up. I don't know. It's really tough. I find it, if you can notice that you should be shutting up and you've said too much, that's good that you're noticing it instead of just being bitter in the end and not knowing why, that you saw something in this person that you wanted to help guide and help, and then they got mad at you, you know, and or they don't understand. Or been many moments where I've tried to offer help to somebody, I see their problem, and then they don't ask for my opinion, and I just start blurting out, well, this is what you should do. Don't you see you're doing this? And it never goes well. It's always met with some kind of criticism, like, oh, you just know it all, or no, but you don't understand this other thing's going on, or whatever. And they don't really hear the guidance. So I found the best thing for me, the way that I usually approach this now is if I'm in a deep conversation with somebody and I can see that they're expressing something that is an issue or something they're not happy with, and I can somewhat sense that what the problem may be, I just try to listen as purely as I can and not focus on, oh, I have the answer for you. Let me guide you because I need to be seen. Or for whatever the reason is. But listening is such an important part of being a projector, is like actually using your auric field and plugging in and just listening authentically. Other people can feel that, and it feels really nice when you actually tune into their experience, put yourself in their shoes, and absorb the information and the way that they feel. And by doing that and just focusing on that and holding space and not speaking at all, like just don't talk, and even when the ideas come up, just keep it to yourself. It's eventually the quietness starts to become awkward for the other person, or they finally feel done unloading everything. And then oftentimes comes somewhat of an invitation of like, hey, why are you being so quiet? Or what do you think? Or I see you're just like, your mind's going and you're not saying anything. Like, what are you thinking? And now there's a little bit more of a vulnerable space and an openness to say whatever you think you need to say. The other big thing that I find is, as a projector, is there's a lot that projectors can see and sense at times. And if we haven't been seen for the wisdom and guidance that we do have to offer at times, we can be really bitter about that and feel alone. And so what I've found is when I'm in that state, I tend to be really judgmental internally in my head about this other person's issues. Things like, well, why can't they see that this is the issue? You're just looping on something and you're not paying attention to the real matter at hand, or whatever it is. And this judgmental thing is not good, because when we're judging, we're not being open. We're kind of closing off any kind of bridge that would be possible there to offer the guidance, and also like really empathize with what is going on with someone else. Because the more we judge, we start to kind of compare and put a hierarchy to things. And we can think maybe, oh, we're better than this person because we can see their problem. And why aren't they're just looping, and like, I've got to fix them. This is all kind of like a judgmental place. Like, they need me. And I think when we're in judgment, we are closing off to the universal, like, diversity of things. Everybody is uniquely different and has a different perspective and an experience of life to draw from. That is the primary thing that I try to always lean back to. And not being in a place of judgment offers this more expansive place of openness and love and acceptance of where the other person's at, and that's perfect where it is. And then in that state, there's just a lot more opportunities for invitations and guidance, and someone actually seeing you for the stillness and wisdom that you have to offer, and not feeling like they're being judged by you. Because I think as a projector, being so, with the aura being so pointed and so hyper-focused on one individual, if you're not from a balanced place, it's just going to feel like judgment. And I've had a lot of experience with this where I have crossed that line and people feel judged by me. And sometimes it's even when I'm not saying something, they can hear it in the ether. They can feel that I'm judging them, and that doesn't feel good from anybody. So I think trying to be aware of that is a huge part of it, but the power of silence is monumental. It's huge. When you just stay silent, even though you want to say the things and you see the problem, just being silent is sometimes the guidance that they need, and it's the best thing to do in the moment. Next question from the same person: how do you ground yourself after hits and epiphanies? I ground myself by physically getting my feet in the ground, like in the grass, for sure, is just obvious. But I also sleep with a grounding mat on our bed. So every night, you know, you spend 8 hours sleeping. If you're grounding that whole time, it's really great. And then the other thing that I've learned is to not just physically ground, but try to, whatever hit or epiphany or download that you want to call it that comes in, can sometimes just be circling in the mind, more so than actually bringing it into your body and embodying the wisdom and actually acting on it in the reality. So I find it helpful to try to figure out whatever this epiphany is, to try to enact it in my life, do something in the reality that represents this epiphany, and that helps me kind of put it into the manifested world and bring it into the reality. Because it does not do any help to just let it circle in your mind and feel that you know the thing now. And so all the work's done. Like I have the knowledge, because it's only going to get you so far unless you're actually applying it in the reality. And I had to learn that the hard way, because I spent years just like up in my mind and my head, understanding so many new things about myself and about reality and the universe and how consciousness works. And I felt very smart, and I felt for moments very healed and like wise in a lot of ways. But it starts to get you, you start to sound kind of crazy to people, and you don't really get the satisfaction of that knowledge. You don't feel it. You don't embody it every day. And so it takes a lot of practice. It's very easy to get up in the mind and have epiphanies and downloads all the time, because you have substances you can use. You have lectures and podcasts, YouTube to listen to other people's perspectives that can really open doors for your own perspective. But it's a whole nother thing to try to embody that and really ground it into your everyday being and knowing that that is real and true by experiencing it. And so it's situational depending on what the epiphany is. Sometimes you can't just like act it out or do something in the reality with that, but try to figure out if there's a way, even if you can do some kind of metaphorical act that represents that knowledge, I have found to be helpful. I don't do it all the time, but it's something that I know that does work. And so that's what I would say. Grounding is super awesome too. When you really understand, I learned a lot about, I dove into the idea that just the electrical, idea of humans, that we are electrical. Like if you just think about it in a simple way, what is like making our heart beat every day? When you think about electricity, everything's got to be plugged into the wall, right? It's got to get the power and energy from some source. And that goes all the way back to the coal plant or the solar energy or whatever. But just in your house, it's like, okay, to run this computer, it's got to be plugged into the wall, and now it can run. I can't take this computer out into the woods and just run it because I need electricity. But we as beings can just like move about the cabin throughout the whole world, and we never have to plug into the wall. And I thought about this as a kid sometimes, like, how are we doing this? And so then science would say, oh, well, it's because you put food in your body and then that creates the energy. You put water and food in your body and that gives you the energy. But still, where does that, like, how does the food get its energy? So the animal then has energy that we ate, or the plant has energy, but then how's it getting its energy? Is it plugged into the wall somewhere? No, I haven't seen a cow with its tail plugged into the wall. But then you start to really tune into like, okay, there's this idea that we are electrical beings, our aura, our everything about our body is pulling energy from somewhere, and that there's energy in the air, in the ether. And it's something you can't see, but the most powerful things in the world are things you cannot see. So with that idea, also with the plug in the wall, you have a ground in it that helps balance the energy. Without a ground, you get shocked, or you will have a surge of energy and it'll blow out your computer. So the grounding is a hugely important part in being electrical and having energy. So with this concept, I started to realize, like, oh God, that's what grounding is. Like, you can't be energetic. It can't be an energetic being and just fly around the world move about the world without grounding. It's very important to balance the energy and keep things in line. So it's a very important part physically to get your feet on the ground. And, I mean, at times I lay on the ground, I get my whole damn body up in that grass because it's, you can feel it when you really tune into it and get sensitive with it. Everything starts to like really balance out. And so when I need that, if I'm kind of having an anxious day or there's a lot going on in my head and I am just circling around in my brain a lot in the mind, then I will go lay on the ground in the sun and everything balances out. So I think tuning into actually understanding grounding and what it how it actually is functioning. It's like an integral part, helped me really integrate it into my life because I know how important it is now. I heard people saying grounding all the time, like, okay, you need to go ground. It sounds boring to me. Like, I got to go put my feet. Come on. I'm like thinking about the concepts of the universe and I understand that we're all one and all this other shit. I'm not going to go put my feet in the ground. But really when you dive deep on that electrical being stuff, it's profound. A good source for that is this guy named Dan Winter. You should check out his YouTube stuff. It's really dense, but he is an electrical engineer who also has had like a Kundalini awakening and is very into mystical spiritual concepts. And so he harmonizes the two. Again, in a very dense way, it's hard to understand sometimes if you don't have an engineering background, but it was profound when I dove deep on some of his videos that to really understand these concepts of your aura, of grounding, of the Taurus field, of how your energy works and all of this. It's really great to check out. All right. Next question. What's your perspective on the earth, animals, plants, fungi, etc. in terms of consciousness? So I believe that that's all really connected. It's all, we come from the earth. So we're all deeply connected to the animals, plants in general. We are connected in a way that we have mostly forgotten because of the other magnificent things to get lost in the culture and the materialistic things. But when I've always loved nature as a kid, like I just loved playing in the woods. I used to dig holes and make forts underground and make tree houses. And I'd get ringworm all the time, get tick bites and things when I was a kid. Luckily, I never got Lyme. I'm somehow impervious to it. I've had so many tick bites in Nashville and never got Lyme. Jessica got Lyme after like one tick bite. I have over time starting to understand more of myself, understand consciousness, spirituality, all these things. You really start to get a sensitivity back to what nature actually is and how it's operating in this magnificently balanced way. So I've learned to be able to communicate a bit more on a level with nature and observe it really for all its wisdom and the way that it's constantly balancing out. It's this perfect harmonious thing. You can also look at it a way where, you know, nature's so beautiful and harmonious in certain ways, the way the flowers like come back every year in spring and have this beautiful presentation at night, the bugs and the birds in the daytime, all creating this sonic, beautiful orchestra. But on the flip side, nature is metal, as they say. And the dark side of nature is profound to learn from as well, because when you look at it and observe it, if you're watching a lion eat a gazelle, or, you know, our cats, sometimes they'll go out and they'll catch a bird, and it is hard to watch because we project a lot of pain and suffering onto it. And so it can be really gory and hard to understand from a human aspect of wanting to avoid pain and suffering. But you see the way nature has this like balance. And if you really watch an animal getting eaten, and that's gnarly, I don't like necessarily recommend going to watch it, but I've had to watch it a lot, like living in nature, I've had to observe it. And I've chose sometimes to just watch and not intervene. I used to, like in the past, when I would see, you know, an animal on the side of the road that had gotten hit still alive, I'd go out of my way to try to take it out of its misery. But I've started to learn over time that it's like not really my place to do that, because I've observed a certain part of nature that seems to like embrace death. And there's something that I think occurs when these beings of nature that don't really have a moral compass and have a idea of self so much. There are some that do seem to portray some sense of identity and self, the more advanced ones like dolphins and dogs and cats sometimes. But when they are faced with death, there seems to be something that happens where a peace overcomes them and they go with the flow. So if you do watch like a lion and a gazelle, the classic example, once the gazelle is actually attacked and the lion has got it in its mouth and the death starts to occur, the gazelle goes into a relief almost. It doesn't really start to fight for its life anymore. It goes into some Zen state and seems to almost be not feeling pain and in some kind of euphoria transition. And a lot of people, you know, say this is DMT expelling in their brain, which if you've ever done DMT, it definitely, there's a lot of euphoria and there's a lot of dissociation of the material world, where pain doesn't exist and you start to transition into, the other world. And so that aspect of nature has just been so profound to me, because the way that it doesn't resist death or resist any kind of destruction, it somehow knows to go with the flow. And that if you understand that there is no real thing as death, as far as we like understand it in culture, that there's life beyond it, that we exist on another realm, watching nature do its thing, it's profound. It's so in balance. It cannot be stopped. We like to think that, I mean, this is controversial with the climate change stuff, but I don't believe that we could actually destroy the earth or destroy nature. I think we can, you know, destroy parts of it in a very unbalanced way. The way the developments happen now is so brutal to watch, with no care and concern for animals, plants, trees that have been there for hundreds of years, just chop them down in 10 minutes and build a shitty house on there that's going to not survive more than 10 years anyways. So there's, you know, I think our culture does not understand nature in the way and the profound aspects that are there, and does not know how to harmoniously live with it. And so I don't agree with a lot of the acts that the culture has on nature at all. I'm living in a house right now where there's a huge multi-million dollar development happening all around us, and I've had to watch them cut down trees and disseminate these forests that were beautiful, just to build these fucking dumb houses on it and stack them all up next to each other with no yards. It's awful. I hate it. But nature is profound. It's so powerful. And the earth is so powerful that there's not something that we could do to destroy it, because it is so in balance. Again, we can slow that down and we can mess things up for sure. But when you tune into this part of nature, you see really how profound the littlest things are. Fungus is something that, you know, I think a lot of people are onto now, about its magnificent qualities in the mycelium network, how it communicates with the entire forest. The idea that fungus grows off of dead things, it's filling this void where something that is dead and seemingly waste and is nothing that you would find useful, the fungus has figured out how to create life there, create life where something's dying. It's so in balance. It's so incredible how that works. So I think it's very interlocked with consciousness, and who we are. And the more that we tune back into that balance and how it's working, I think the more we can benefit from learning how to harmoniously live with it, and to benefit ourselves and benefit the earth and benefit the profound harmonious like thing that's happening with nature, you know? So it's a long-winded answer. I could go on forever about that stuff. I there's so much wisdom to be gained from just observing nature, and it does take presence. We're so used to going to the movies, going to the club, getting like this external distraction, that going for a walk in the woods doesn't feel exciting to people, a lot of people. And it also, I think when we go do it, we don't actually try to really get present and not think about, well, I'm going to the club tonight, or what am I going to do later? And not really absorb what's going on in the woods, because it's a profound like orchestra of life doing its thing. There's death happening everywhere. There's life happening everywhere. And it's perfectly doing both of those things in such a unique, balanced way that's profound. I'll stop there. I used to take, in the band, but when it started, we had to take press training, which is really stupid. But one of the things they used to always say is, when you start talking too much and you keep going, and you can tell that you're rambling on and not giving just a pointed quick answer that's like quotable in a magazine. They made us wear rubber bands and you had to like snap the rubber band when you were talking too much to get a habit of trying to be concise and not just ramble. But I don't have a rubber band on, so I didn't snap. But that would have been a moment that I could have snapped the rubber band. Okay. What is a book you think everyone needs to read at least once? For me, I mean, I have so many favorite books. A lot that have blown my mind and helped my growth and healing. But one of the ones that if you say everyone needs to read at least once, it's kind of a boring one as far as if you're getting into like some of the real profound esoteric books, but it's not boring as in it's not important. Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, is such a simple book and such a like kind of basis of all spiritual development and kind of the beginnings of it to me. I mean, it was for me. It was like a book that really opened a huge door for me. But the importance of being present and being in that now moment is like integral to everything else. So any of these other higher concepts of esoteric and secret occult ideas, and just higher consciousness that starts to get really heady. If you don't know how to be present in the moment and present with your life, none of that really matters because you just get spun out in your mind and you start to have psychosis, you start to lose it. And so really understanding as a starting point, what the now moment entails, how to get there, how to sustain it, how it benefits everything else is so important. And I've read that book 3 or 4 times, all of his books. There's like a series, of those early ones. And, I think it's a definitely important one that everybody should read because being present with yourself, being able to sit and be bored and have nothing to do and quiet your mind, it fixes so many things. It's where all wisdom is. You can dilate time with that. Being super present, being present with a friend or a loved one is where you can actually fully listen and put yourself in someone else's shoes and have empathy. You can learn, you can relate to people that way. I think we definitely as a culture right now could benefit from a lot more presence. We're kind of sick with distractions and it's so subtle. We don't even realize that like daily we are in every moment highly distracted and is constantly pulling us away from ourselves. So empowering ourselves to really know how to be present with everything that we do is just so fucking important. So I would read that book and have it in your library to go to every now and then just to remind yourself of the importance of it and how to do it. All right. And it's not just meditation stuff too. Like just to clarify, because a lot, I meditate, but I was meditating a lot of my life and didn't know I was. I was just being half present. And so you can be meditating in a lot of different scenarios. You don't have to be like cross-legged on the ground, eyes closed. That's a great way too. But this book gets into that a little bit more where it's not just about going, zen, and now I'm in the now moment. Like you can just be walking down the street with a lot of distractions and be so tuned in to the present moment and not be thinking backwards or forwards. And there's just, it's a profound thing that comes from that. So... okay. I don't know what I'm talking about though, so don't listen to me. What's a piece of advice you've been given that has stuck with you if you want to share? I don't really know. I mean, a lot of the advice that I take that sticks with me was mostly from books and stuff. Let me think. Elton John once told us to, the first thing you need to do when you get money is go buy a house. That was, I'm trying to think of someone cool that gave me advice that you guys would be like, whoa, that's fucking cool. But that's not really that cool. I think it's important, but you don't need a house. Go buy a tiny home or a fucking tent is fine. Yeah, I don't have any good answers for that. Sorry. Just wanted to name drop old Elton, Sir Elton John. I actually, funny story, I met when we met him, I didn't realize he had recently been princed, knighted, whatever. He got knighted, I think. He's a prince. Or is a knight. Is there a difference? And I don't know if it was recent, but I mean, whatever. Everybody knew he was that. And we were playing his Grammy party when we went to the Grammys. And I, before we met him, like we had a sound check and he actually came out and like hung with us for a bit. He was really cool, super nice, sweet dude. And it was awesome. But just before that, when we met him actually at this like little lunch thing, he came. I was not at the table. I was getting a drink or something. And he came over to the table and then I showed up and he had kind of just met everybody at our table, the whole band and our crew and stuff. And then they, like, I was going to sit down and then Mark was like, oh, hey, like Elton, this is Mark. And then I just went, I was like, hey dude, and shook his hand. And then he looked at me kind of funny and then smiled. And then we went on and then I sat down and then everybody was like, dude, you can't, he's a knight, man. You can't just say, hey, dude, that's not proper. You have to respect him. And I was like so confused and embarrassed because I was just trying to relate to him, like saying, hey, dude, like, you know, trying to be relatable and friendly, not like nervous in front of someone like that. So it was it's a funny story. I didn't realize that I had to bow or something to him. Can you ramble about cannabis and spirituality? Would love to find a balance, but it's sticky. As in that sticky weed, right? Sticky weed. It's fucking stupid. This is a good question. I have a deep respect for cannabis. I got caught up in being too into it for a little while. But I don't know. I had a lot of I smoked cannabis when I was like tiny, I guess I was like 12 years old or something. So it's like the first time I smoked it and, it was actually oregano. So it didn't really work. It did burn the hell out of my throat. But, pretty quickly after that, I actually got cannabis from somebody that actually knew what they were doing when they bought it. And it was cool. I remember as a kid though, not being like hearing all these stories about it and then it not being that effective. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'm high. But I remember kind of trying to act more high than I was because all my friends were like loopy high. And, I think I smoked it a couple more times and then never really touched it again until I was about 26. Well, probably maybe even 27, 28. Because it was after the band had become successful and I had built my own little studio at this house I was living at with my sister. And I just wanted to like spark up my creativity. I was trying to make my own music at the time and just like on the side. And I had a lot of friends that smoked a lot for creativity. And so I went to try it. I got some and then it was amazing how creative it made me be and how many like boundaries dropped from my insecurities of making music and being creative. So I loved it and started to really incorporate it into creating art. And then life started to happen and problems started to come into life and situations that I was anxious and whatnot. And so I started using it a lot more and I had the privilege of being able to be in a band with a lot of money and a lot of access to drugs. So I got it whenever I wanted it and got it wherever I needed it. And so it was easy to abuse, basically. And I started using it like daily, just 9 to 5, kind of being high all the time. And I could do anything while high. I smoked sativa primarily and never, I wasn't the kind of person that vegged out and kind of became incompetent and couldn't like be in reality and be responsible. I was almost more productive when I was smoking and more kind of tuned in the beginning. So I would smoke it a lot and like every moment because it was fun to do. And I resonated with it. But then over time, you know, like with anything, if you get out of balance with it, anything that's good can become bad at some point. And so I started to get anxious about not having it. And it would start to feel like this loop of every time I would get a lot and smoke it, like as I get halfway through, I was like, okay, I'm anxious about when I'm going to not get it again. If I'm going to be traveling, do I need to set it up? Where? And I would just have a lot of anxiety about that. And then I started to not, the tolerance started to go so high that I had to smoke so much a day. And I kind of got addicted to tobacco because I smoked blunts. And that wasn't good. My dad died from COPD from smoking. So I didn't enjoy that part of it, but I kind of got the bite of tobacco. Anyways, I'm rambling about it. The way it connected to spirituality for me was amazing. I definitely used it as in a place to deal with my physical reality and the problems that were going on. But then it was connecting me to a higher part of myself and a higher truth. And it was able to, you know, I would drop all the barriers that I had in life and all the difficulties. And then I would start to access more real parts of myself and gain a little bit of courage to pull those into reality. And I loved deep diving on concepts and reading a book or talking and discussions with people about these higher concepts and consciousness. Having weed allowed me to kind of like probe into that more. But it started to become a problem with me communicating, actually. I would start to get on a concept and an idea and then out of nowhere just blank. And that was there was something to do with the weed. At certain points, I would listen to myself talk high and not be very coherent. So I started to realize that I was like a little bit too up in the clouds to be in the physical world and actually like relate to people and bring these ideas back into the reality. And then I started having difficulties just in relationships. It was very bitter and kind of moody when I was smoking a lot, because part of me just wanted to like keep getting high and my tolerance was out. So it got way out of whack. I think that primarily it's a really great tool for growth and development, spirituality, for creativity. But like all tools, you can't just use it all the time. I think I had to learn how to have a lot of intention and ritual around it to get the benefits of it. And in a way, it's just a lot of respect for what it was. And that doesn't mean using it every single day. But I did need to do that to figure that out. So I don't discourage just following your heart and what you want to do with it. I'm an advocate for playing out your vices to the fullest extent to get the message that you need to get it in balance or you need to stop completely with it. You got to be careful with that because some vices are deadly. But I forget his name, but somebody said, a fool who persists in his folly will soon become wise. And I think that's kind of what that I took that to be, is you just have to keep chugging along with whatever you think is right for you until you figure out and actually get the message that it's not right for you. And then you're actually capable of stopping it. When I tried to stop smoking so many times because I thought it was the right thing to do or somebody would encourage me to do it, but inside I really wanted to, I would just stop for a month or so or a couple months, and then it would sneak back in because really I wanted to do it. And so I had to oscillate back and forth until finally this one point near the end of smoking it, I had not had it for a while and actually got into this really great high vibe place where I felt almost high. I felt euphoric. I felt present, and I felt like I had healed so many things and was just like sustaining a really great place of joy and acceptance of a lot of hardship in my life. And then I had already reached out to try to get some weed, and my contact wasn't there. And so it was like 2 weeks later or something, and then he showed up and was like, hey, I've got it. You can come by and get it. So I got excited and was like, okay, great. I'll go get some. And then I rolled up a little bomber and smoked it, and I felt myself descend into a like lower vibration, like a lower place that was not as joyful as I was feeling and like kind of open and expansive as I was feeling. I felt it actually kind of cloak over the reality and like box me in a little bit, to where I started overthinking things and starting to have a little anxiety again. And so I really could sense that the cannabis brought me down. And that's when I realized, I was like, oh, I'm done with this. I think I don't need to have it anymore. I had already worked on balancing it and having intention when I used it, not just smoking it every day. I would only use it for creativity or when I really couldn't deal with the reality. But at this point, you know, I think a lot of these things are here for us. The plant medicines are there to help us heal, but they're not there to help us. They're not there to like become vices and that they just become a substance that we use constantly to get to a place in our consciousness. I think we're supposed to learn how to get to that resonance and that frequency on our own doing without the substance. And it's hard because it can become a vice because it does solve problems. It kind of just launches you into that high space. But if you don't learn how to get there yourself, then you're just going to be like using the substance and not empowering yourself. And I think you need to know how to get there on the transition. Like, just as a side note, I think when we die, if you're addicted to a substance, you're going to die and you're still going to be there thinking and you're going to be looking for the joint and you can't get there. You can't get the joint through the death portal. So you need to be able to get high vibe on yourself. It's just a weird thought, but that's kind of where I took it. Once I felt that descent from it, I just was like, okay, easy. I'll just stop because I got there by myself. I don't want to do this again. And that's been my journey with it. I think it's not everybody's journey. I think there's a lot of people that still are very tuned into themselves and have a high state of consciousness that's grounded into the reality, and they still use it. And I think that's great too. But for me, it definitely became a crutch at some point, and I didn't want to have that crutch anymore. And again, with all these substances, I think it's important to, when you use them, try to feel into your body of what is happening when that you rise into that state, and to feel into like, can I get here again? How do I make this a blueprint of for my own consciousness without the substance to rise into that space again? And it does involve, you have to actually heal. You have to deal with your shit. So that's my ramble on cannabis. Here's another weed, cannabis one. What was your experience of stopping smoking cannabis like? Challenges and joys? Just told you. How do I make art for me? I feel like I need an audience to validate my creations. Well, this is a good one. I hear you on thinking you need an audience to validate your creations. And on some level, that is true, right? You can't just create something and never show it to anybody. I mean, you can. That's what I've been doing for years. But it's not fulfilling. And it feels like you can't, the art has actually not done its service when it's not being shown or impressed on to other people. So you do need somewhat of an audience. But when you're creating the art, you do not need to worry about the audience. Do not think about the audience. Do not think about who's going to listen to it. And don't give a flying fuck about what they're going to say about it, if it's good or bad, because it just impedes the authentic expression and it starts to filter in. It puts a filter on like what you actually want to bring forth, and you start to bend towards what you think someone else wants you to bring forth. There's a thing called audience capture that happens on a bigger level of creators that start to influence big audiences, that the audience starts to, if you're not careful, the audience can start to dictate what the artist can dictate or like affect what the artist is going to output. And you become captured by this phenomena and you start to not create your authentic, you start to close off the channel of the universe that's you're collaborating with to make great art. And you start to bend towards something that somebody wants you to be. And therefore you start to become stagnant and you're not tuning in to what your unique gift is. That might not be something that the audience thinks they want to hear. And I think that's the more truthful way to go. A lot of the great genius acts of art in life, I think, were always things that were outside the box and that the culture didn't quite understand at first. Only till later did we realize that this was some wonderful act of creation that we never thought would have been so wonderful. So not worrying about the audience is, like, I think, primary to when you're creating. Because if you do become successful and the audience becomes really big and you're worrying about the audience, you're worrying about pleasing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you just can't do it. It gives you anxiety and you cannot uphold, you can't like meet that need by the audience. And you then start to fall off. It's kind of like the phenomena of one-hit wonders, or why you see people make it. Their first record is incredible, and then over time their records start to become kind of more algorithmic and homogenized. It's because they're playing towards the audience instead of themselves. So the key here is just authenticity, man. I think that the one thing that we all need in this world is for everybody to be their individual true selves. And that way we can all understand more about what we're doing here as beings and how we're each individually unique and have something wonderful to offer as that unique individual, and not comparing ourselves to other, which who's better or not. It's all subjective. And it can be this beautiful fractal thing, just like nature is, where every little piece of us has value and can help us all see more of who we are as a whole. And so that's the thing to focus on when you're trying to create art for yourself. Just do it for yourself only. And if somebody likes it, great. And I can almost guarantee you, if you're making it truly as yourself and something that you are just bleeding out, somebody's going to like it. Especially in the world today where we have so much access to millions of people, there's going to be somebody that it's going to change their life. And if you've changed one person's life, it's profound. That is the job is done. So you don't need to worry about getting a big audience, or you don't have enough followers or any of that. Just keep focusing on what you need to offer and what your uniqueness is, and it will find its way. Next question. What do you consider your topic of expertise? I'm inviting you to talk about it. Oh, that's nice. A nice little projector nod there, an invitation. What do I consider my topic of expertise? I don't know. I guess, as I was saying earlier, I feel like I do have a good compass on when somebody's being authentic or not. And I don't know if that's arrogant to say or not, but when I'm listening to art and music, it started as a thing where I just didn't like art that was trying to be something else or being inauthentic. I didn't listen to it. I didn't like it. Or I didn't watch a movie that was like that. That was just another repeat of something, or trying to be a movie that had already happened. It was primarily with music, I would say, because that's been my craft. But now I look at that as like, oh, it's because they're just not being authentic. I like soul in music. If I hear some aspect of someone's soul being bled out and talked about, or I can hear it in the music, then it resonates with me and I love it. And I put it into my repertoire of music that I listen to inspire me. So I've learned to see that in relationships with people too. When I relate to someone else, I can tell when they're being authentic or not. And a big part of this was in the success that I had as being a musician. I kind of had to use that gauge as a safety mechanism, because what happens when you do get any kind of success and a lot of people start looking up to you or valuing you for something, and they kind of need something from you or want something from you. They want to be associated with you because you're successful, and they themselves are trying to get a foot in the door, or they can benefit from the money you have, the access you have. So they want to be your friend because then they can get in the doors. Things like this that are just part of the ethos of being successful in this culture. We got a lot of vampires out there. And I think that I had to learn how to sense when someone was being authentic and when they wanted to be my friend or hang out, and when they were just trying to get something from me. And so I learned how to be able to kind of filter through that as a safety mechanism, because when I had people around me that were just trying to benefit off me, it's just not satisfying. It's not helpful for anybody. It doesn't make me happy. It makes me feel abused. And so I like picked that up, I think, a lot in that experience of life. And now learning more about myself, learning more about spirituality and consciousness, I can see that there's a, that's something that I do notice and pick up on a lot. And being a projector, I think that that maybe is something that is, that I do have to offer if I am trying to guide someone, is sensing whether they're being authentic or not and how to maybe tune into that authenticity. I know when I work with people in music, that that's a huge focus of mine. I when we're collaborating, we have to get to a place of authenticity or I don't last long. I'm not here to imitate things and encourage somebody to imitate and be like someone else. I like working with people that are ready to get down into themselves and pull out something that they think is impossible. That is so much fun to me. And I love creating an environment that feels safe for that, creating a playful space to explore what's inside an individual. So I do that a little bit with music. I mean, I work with one artist right now. It's like a band that they're very much like that, you know, whether they are aware of that or not, that's how they seem to be operating most of the time. And I mean, definitely when I'm working with them, we get to that place. We don't really talk. Well, we have talked about that, but that's, I guess that's a part of my expertise. That was my instinctual answer, my splenic answer. But I'm also an expert in ping pong. So, okay. How often do you play / record acoustic drums versus composing electronic samples for music? I used to record drums all the time, like primarily acoustic drums in my old studio, because I had a really sick setup and had really perfected the sound. And I prefer that because it's kind of where I can express most purely. And I can get my sound across. My feel is something that I've worked on for a long time to express. And so when I'm on a drum kit, that's how it most purely comes out. And then I would, you know, sometimes make those sounds more electronic sounding instead of organic or a blend of the two. But lately, I don't have the same kind of studio setup. It's a little more limited. I still have space for the drum kit, but I don't have it mic'd up and kind of haven't put a lot of technical engineering skills to use yet to get it refined to a place that I can just jump on it all the time. So I primarily, when I'm feeling creative, I just kind of get in here and start working, and I mostly use electronic drum kits and drum machines and stuff. Next. Sorry, this is really long. What helped you find your flow as a projector? The biggest thing as a figuring out flow as a projector is knowing when to not work, knowing when to just like rest and not try to over push yourself because you think you need to, because the world tells you work ethic is something that you have to show up to every day. It's just not the same thing for a projector. And I know it's hard for other people that their energy doesn't work like that to understand this, because it's not congruent with what culture says and what primarily, you know, generators and Manny generators and manifestors do. It's, they have an abundance of energy to pull from. As a projector, we don't have all that energy. We have to get it from interacting with another person. And so there are times when I have tried to like just push myself, whether that was like in the band, like because we had a responsibility to get things done at a certain time, or just on my own. And it never, I would never really make great things. I would get by, but really getting in that flow state involves for a projector to be full of energy and not be wasted, tired. You know, so I've tried to push myself. It's still something I struggle with, to just sit and like rest. Jessa makes fun of me all the time because I'll say that in the morning, like, oh, today it's just, I'm spent. I'm going to chill today and just not do anything, read or whatever. And by noon I'm like painting a wall and building a fucking table and trying to make music or something. So it isn't easy with the mind of a projector wanting to kind of like jump on things and work things out or whatever. But it's for getting into flow. I specifically recognize it when I'm trying to be creative. I cannot get into that channel state and get into a real flow state without knowing when to go and when to stop. So I think that's an important aspect of it. And it's probably like different for each individual, the way that you're aligned, like all the other aspects of human design that are specific, where your authority is and where all these other things are that give you more information on like exactly how to know when to be aware that you have energy and when you can start to like get activated on something. But for me, it's an internal feeling that I know I have energy. I have actually rested for a couple of days, or I got my ass handed to me and was forced to rest. I got sick or whatever. Then there's just kind of an urge and a scratch that needs to be itched that, I know that something's open for me. The portal's kind of opening and I can go get into that space. And then the other thing is when I'm not excited anymore, so I'll go in and start flowing and get in lost in this kind of no time and working on a song. And then at some point I will get a little bit bored, or I'll start to I can tell that I'm not really creating good things anymore. I'm not like on the fringe, on this like cutting edge of tapping into things. I'm kind of repeating myself, or I'm having to listen to something over and over again and can't find the idea. When that happens, it's like a time to just stop and to break up the flow. And so then I'll just stop doing that and go get into something else, literally anything else but music. I can go mow the lawn. I'll go sit and talk with Jessa. I'll go sit and read a book. I'll go have lunch, go for a walk, do anything else, and wait for that kind of itch to come back. And then I'll jump back in. And it can seem, you know, paradoxical, because a lot of people say you got to work every day and it takes a lot of effort for greatness. But for projectors, and for me specifically, it doesn't really work quite like that. Like, you have to go from 9 to 5 every day and just like show up all the time and put the effort in. If I show up twice in 1 week, I could get as much done, if not more, than if I showed up every day during that week. By the end of the week, I will have more work to show for and better work. It's not always more work, but it's definitely better. And that's more what I'm trying to go for anyways. I would rather have better things than an abundance of the work. So it's trying to really figure that out for yourself, is like when to take a break. There's some really great producers out there that do that, actually. And I don't know if they know about human design or they've just listened to themselves, but some massive producers, they come into the studio for like 40 minutes and they're on fire and they get like just hook after hook, amazing parts. And then they're like, cool, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go piss off for a little bit. And they'll come back 4 hours later, jump in 40 minutes, boom, fire again. And then they're out. And it's like, it works so well, you know. But if we're kind of thinking that there's this one way to do it, and you have to show up every day all the time, it just doesn't work for everybody. And I think that's okay. So, all right. Man, I'm talkative today. This is healthy, huh? Hopefully it's not annoying. Got a couple more here and then I'll be done. Sorry if I didn't answer all these questions. I'm trying to kind of blast through. There's some good ones. There's some not good ones, but that's all good. What challenges do you find as a projector in your relationship to music / working with a musician? It's kind of what all the stuff I just said, is figuring out when to get in and out and communicating that to another person in the most clear way possible. You don't have to say, hey, listen, I'm a projector, human design. What are you? This is how I got to work. You don't even have to do any of that. You just try to explain, like, I work best when I'm feeling really excited in here. And I might, when I'm not feeling excited, I just need to take a break. And that doesn't mean that I don't like this or it's not going well. It's how I work best is I pop in and out and I'm going to show up when I show up. And I'll be all there and I will be ready to work hard and like we will get some great stuff. But it's not healthy for me to be forcing myself to stay in here just because we need the song done. We're not going to get something good and we're not going to be happy in the end. So trying to communicate those things clearly, I think a lot of musicians and real artists will vibe with that. There's some part of them that understands that, even if they can't logically make sense of it. Most good artists get that there's like everybody's unique and has a certain way they do things. So that's helped me I haven't been in a lot of situations since I've understood this about myself. I overworked myself before, but since then, people that I've worked with, I just communicate that and it fucking works great. Okay. It's a repeat question. I've kind of answered some of these questions just in general because I've been blabbering on about other stuff. So hopefully I'm not going to restate some of these. Mark, what's your favorite kind of alien? humans. Okay. I think that's all. Did we get them all? Let me scan through. Yeah, I think we're good. This has been like 2 hours anyway, so that's long enough to hear me fucking talk. I'm trying to get my sea legs again. Really appreciate it if you have listened this long. There was a question I feel like... there were a couple questions now that I'm thinking about it, that people asking about my music when I'm releasing it and stuff. I've released some of my music that I have made for Jess's podcast. I did release it on Spotify very quietly a while ago under the name Suitnop, Suitnop. It's my last name backwards. On Instagram, it's Suitnop with a 5 instead of an S because Bob Pontius has Suitnop. I don't know who Bob Pontius is, but he's got my name. So I had to put a 5 in front of it. But I put two EPs out. It's just the collection of the music that I did for Jess's podcast. There are two EPs called Phage 1 and Phage 2, Phage. And I've got a lot of other music that I am hoping to release at some point, but I've just been kind of constipated with the actual releasing of it and finalizing and finishing it. So I think I'm kind of embarking on a new timeline of life where I will be more apt to put that stuff out and be a little bit more public and express artistically in the world instead of being a recluse. So hopefully soon. I know I've been saying that for a long time, but that's about it, y'all. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you all, and I appreciate the questions. Maybe we'll do the questions again because that was fun and much easier for me to make a 2-hour podcast with. All right. I love you. Bye. Thank you.